the Loan Market Association, multi-currency term and revolving facilities agreement. We're looking at the key provisions, core terms and conditions of this standard document, which is the core set of measures behind the international euro-dollar loan market system. We've got the basic contents. I've given you a separate summary which restates this using my structure and outline. It's in exactly the same terms. It's just, I think, what I've done is slightly easier to follow. You can see the overall structure. But what we now need to do is we need to start working through these key provisions in further detail. So what have we got? We've got the company. The company's the primary borrower. We've then got the subsidiaries, which with the company, together with the company, are the original borrowers. They will be listed in Schedule 1, Part 1. We've then got the subsidiaries, which are also separately defined as the original guarantors, because they all guarantee each other and will take resolutions to confirm the commercial veracity and need justification for that. Collectively, the borrowers and the guarantors are the obligors, and we'll see that later in one of the other sub-definitions. The arranging bank, who's going to set this up, pull the syndicate together, help the borrowers prepare the information memorandum, it's the arranger. And then the lending institutions are the financial institutions, defined as the original lenders, and that includes the banks and then the UK non-bank lenders, which are separately listed in parts 2 and 3 of Schedule 1. You always need to confirm the key definitional terms which are set out in the interpretation. In English standard legal documentation, usually this is at the beginning. In American documentation, very often this will be at the end. This will be the last clause rather than the first clause. All of the key core ideas, parts of this agreement and arrangement are set out here. So we've got the accession letter, that's for borrowers and guarantors. We have additional borrowers, additional cost rates, additional guarantors, additional obligors. Affiliate are other group companies. Agents, spot rated exchange, that's when we're converting currencies. We've got authorization, if there's any authorization, consent, approval, resolution, licensing, exemption, filing, notarization, or registration requirement. This will be in the representation and warranties, possibly in the covers as well. The availability period is the commitment period. That's for how long the borrowers can draw down. And we'll have a separate period for the A's and the B's. In our example, we may have 100 million facility, one company, 9 subsidiaries, 10 lenders that avail it for borrowing $100 million. The commitment period for the A might be 2 years, so you can draw down for the first 2 years. For the B, the revolver, it might be the first 2 years, or it might be 10, or it might be the whole duration, the whole 20 years. Because it's not as large an amount, it could be for the full period. The total available commitment and then total available facility is the A and the B added together. We have a base currency for each transaction, a separate definition of borrower, although that's specified up front at the beginning in the parties, and then we have the break costs. The break costs are the difference between what a bank, a lender, expected to receive for an interest period, less what it can earn by putting the money back into the interbank market for the residual duration of that interest period. That's the break cost. You always need to watch things like the business day, because there's different business days in different countries. In Hong Kong, Saturday will be a business day. Very often in the Middle East, it could be Saturday, it might even be Sunday sometimes. You need to watch this. For example, recently in China, they had a large holiday, but to give an extended holiday, what they actually did was they made the following Saturday and Sunday a business day. So everybody was working on the Saturday and the Sunday so they could have this long extended period together. You need to watch that, because if there's notices being provided or payments to be made and you don't make it or it's not completed on the business day, you're in breach, which is a default. And that could trigger consequences, so you need to always watch this. You need to make your clients aware of these points. The client won't look at this detail. You need to. The commitment will be the proportionate amount each bank's having to make under the total A's and B facilities. Defaults are key provisions, so you must watch the defaults, look at the key clauses, and look at the other key terms which may arise. For example, indebtedness and various other key clauses which we'll come over later. Disruption event, this is to do with the screen rate not being available and the interest rate provision not being easily stated. Then we'll have alternative calculation clauses in 10. We've mentioned this previously. We've got the LIBOR and then we've got the Euribor. We're now moving on to risk-free rates. We've gone from LIBOR to IBORs to risk-free rates, RFRs now. We usually in London use SONIA. We'll use ESTR in Europe and we'll use ESFOR in New York. Event of default, we just tie that back to the clause 23. Facility, facility A, facility B commitment, facility A's and B's. The facility B loan, the facility office is the lender through which each participating bank will make its contribution available. That has to be notified to the agent, so the agent bank can always immediately contact them. If there's any fees to be paid, that will be set out in terms of a fee letter. Finance document includes the agreement, any fee letters, accession letters, any resignation letters, and any other document designated by the agent or by the company. Finance party is the agent, the arranger, or lender. As we've explained previously, the arranger may be a member of the syndicate, although very often they will transfer their obligation so that they don't actually have to make the facilities available. Although it does look good because they're arranging bank to appear to be participating, they may then leave even before the loan agreement is actually signed. We need to check key terms like financial indebtedness. A lot of this will be in standard terms, but you need to become familiar with this because it will include a lot of elements that you didn't expect. And your clients, again, will not be aware of this, so you need to report to them. You need to ensure your client understands all of the commitments that they're entering into. GAAP are the general accounting standards. We talk about general agreed accounting standards, GAAP. We tend to talk about US GAAP and UK GAAP. A lot of it is now dealt with under the International Financial Reporting Standards, IFRS. We are trying to move from US GAAP to the international standards which are prepared out of London, which collectively we now call UK GAAP. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission in New York, in America, agreed, I think it was 2002, that we would move towards the IFRS, the International Financial Reporting Standards. And I think from 2008 onwards, the US authorities for the first time made it clear that international offerings in New York or in America did not have to comply with US GAAP separately. Because what was happening was we had to comply with US GAAP and European or UK or international equivalent of GAAP, which are the IFRSs. The American authorities have said they will move towards the international standards, but we haven't done it yet. So this still causes a problem. We just have to be careful with this. You need to ensure that your clients and the borrowers know exactly which sets of provisions they have to comply with. We have standard definitions of groups, of holding companies, of subsidiaries, affiliates. You will see all of that. That will tie into basic company law definitions that you would expect. You just flick through them, check they're in standard terms. If there's anything unusual, that's the sort of point you'd want to highlight for our negotiation meeting. What are the interest periods? We'll come back and look at that in clause 10. The default period will be 1 month unless there's any other selection. Lenders, LIBOR, there's LIBOR. LIBOR's now been replaced by SONIA or compound SONIA. Compound SONIA is where we take SONIA over a typical interest period, let's say 3 months. We average it. That average SONIA rate is the compound SONIA. LMA is the Loan Market Association itself. Majority lenders, if there is any majority voting which will be provided for, one of the clauses, and we'll look at that later, it's not simple majority, 50%, it's 66 2/3%. Mandatory costs, these are the additional regulatory charges that will be imposed. This used to be quite simple, quite standard, so there was a simple formula in the document. When that became more complex, that LME withdrew it, so we now use standard clauses which are available in the market. As the Bank of England charge, roughly 0.11% of total eligible liabilities, an equivalent Financial Conduct Authority charge, and then there's also a separate ECB, European Central Bank charge. Margin is the bank's profit. What profit do the banks expect to receive? In all conditions, this is what they will receive. If we specify 200% or 250 basis points, that's what the banks receive. And in the end of the day, whatever happens, they will receive 250. Because of all of the extra charge clause, indemnity clauses, guarantee clauses, additional payment clauses, the banks will always receive that. Because if anything else arises, for whatever reason, that will be passed back to the borrower if this is drafted properly and if this works effectively in practice. Month, again, you need to watch your business day, you need to watch your month. It might seem a small point, but it's important. Because some months are 30 days, some are 28, some are even shorter, some are 31. You need to watch this because it's very easy to have a technical breach, a technical default. Your clients need to know this. This is the definition of obligor. It's both a borrower and the guarantor. Optional currencies, because it's a multi-currency, term and revolver, we can change the currency for each interest period in relation to each separate loan. We can have between anything between 200 loans up to 2,400, possibly even 26,000. What we will see is there's actually limits, there's possible limits on the total amount of loans, the total number, and on how we can divide them. So we can merge loans, consolidate loans, and we can have a limit on the total number. And we'll see that because there's various clauses which actually provide for consolidation of loans and for division of loans. You need to watch that as well. Quotation date is just the day on which we produce the screen rate for the standard calculations. Then you've got representations, repeat representations. There's the relevant interbank market there. Resignation letters. If it's a rollover on the Bs, we define that separately. There's the screen rate. Security, what is a security? We need to watch that for the negative pledge clause and if there is any disclosed security to be provided. Specified times, subsidiaries, tax, total commitments, transfer certificate, utilization date. A lot of this is very standard. You just need to become familiar with it. Understand how this works in practice. There's an interesting, I'm not quite sure what the difference is. I'm still thinking about this. We have definitions, but then we also have construction clauses. So, for example, agent, arranger, finance party, these are in the construction or in the definitions, and also key terms like assets, indebtedness, regulation. I'm not quite sure why we put these in the construction rather than the definitions, but they're important because they kind of legal effect. You need to watch this. Because they have legal effect, that's why I would say why are they not in the definitions rather than separate construction clause. We always in these agreements tend to disapply third party rights. We do not want any third parties outside the agreements acquiring rights. That is provided for under many jurisdictions. In the UK it's the Contracts Rights of Third Parties Act 1999, but we're going to disapply that. Then we have the facilities. So we have our facility A, we have our facility B, that's in 2.1. The rights and obligations. We are going to specify that the rights of the parties are several, not joint and several. Now what that means is that each lender is not liable for the commitment obligations of the other lenders. If one lender drops out, the others don't have to make up the difference. If one drops out before execution, the arranging bank will find another member. If it happens after signing, the agent bank will try and find another lender to bring in. But the banks aren't liable for each other's commitments and obligations under the facility. That rights are separate and independent, and each party can sue independently without having to bring any other parties in under what we call joinder. Purpose. We will specify a purpose if there is, the lending is to be made for any particular target facility or particular target object. In practice, standard euro loan deals will not have a purpose, therefore this clause won't be completed. It will either be left blank or delete. Even if it does apply, the banks know what's required to actually confirm whether the purpose has been satisfied or not. So there's a no monitoring obligation. We then have the conditions of utilisation. So no borrower may deliver a utilisation request. So no borrower may draw down unless the agent has received all of the documents set out in Schedule 2, which are the conditions precedent. In the chapter, in my draft book on this, I discuss the difference between the conditions precedent, the representations and warranties, and the covenants. It looks like, because of that simple chronological order, the representations are pre-drawdown, the conditions precedent are pre-loan agreement, and the covenants are post-drawdown. In practice, it's the other way around. The conditions precedent are pre-drawdown, the representations and warranties are pre the legal log, the loan agreement coming into effect, and then the covenants are post-drawdown. What we then do in Schedule 2, we list all of the standard conditions precedents that we'd normally expect to see. You will just look through them, check them all in order, look for any unusual provisions, and then if you're acting on behalf of the borrowers, make sure they're aware of this and that all of the relevant documentation is produced as part of the conditions precedent. What we'll then see is this. The lenders will only be obliged, 4.2, to comply with 5.4, that's participation, if, in the case of a rollover, no event of default. So there must be no event of default continuing or would result from the loan. So it's a conditions precedent that there's no default. Otherwise, the lenders don't have to make funds available. There has been case law in the past about this. Are the lenders under an obligation to lend, and in which circumstances can they step away? It all depends upon the drafting. There's two or three, four different cases which look at different elements of this. It's in the footnotes in the text I've already provided in my chapter from my draft book on this. So there's a specific no default condition. If there's any default, there's no obligation to lend. Sometimes that's called a flawed asset clause. It's more important in the derivatives area, and we can look at that separately. So there's other conditions if there's optional currencies, and then this is the clause I mentioned before about minimum number of loans. We can specify a total maximum number of loans for both the A's and the B's. So we've said that legally, technically, there could be up to over 26,000. That becomes very difficult to administer. It creates additional obligations for all the parties and possibly uncertainty. So we may specify a limit on this. It might be 1,000, it might be 5,000, it might be 10,000. But it could be a very large number, just depending upon how simple the banks want to keep this. It may be quite small. It may be 500, it may be 200, maybe it could even be 100. So then the borrowers need to watch. They've got an availability period. They've got a total number of loans. So if they try to borrow like small amounts, they may find they can't actually draw down everything they expected under the facility. So they just have to watch that. And also you've got those division provisions, and we'll come on to see that later, whereby we can actually consolidate loans as well. So you can cross-refer to section 10.4. A in brackets and B in brackets, and we'll come back and look at that. As you're working through this, you're marking it up to look for these cross-reference provisions. So 4.4, cross-refer to 10.4, A and B, which is consolidation and revision and division. So we've then got the utilisation. This is the drawdown. How do you draw down? You deliver a utilisation request in the form provided, and again, you'll just look through the standard form, which will be attached in Schedule 3. This will identify the facility. It must be A or B. It will identify the amount. It specifies the currency, and it will specify the interest rates. If there's no interest rate specified, the default provision is 1 month. Only one loan may be requested under each utilization request. The utilisation request will apply to all of the syndicate members, which could be 10 or it could be 100, but we separately know from sections 2.1 and sections 2.2 that these obligations are also separate, several and divided. So technically, there's multiple loans between each of the borrowers and each of the lenders. So again, you can cross-refer the provisions back from 5.2 back to, or 5.2b, cross-refer that back to 2.1. You specify the currency, you specify the amount, the lender's participation is their amount in proportion to what they undertook to make available to the facility. What essentially happens is this, in practice, one of the borrowers advises the agent bank, we want to draw down this amount on this day in this currency for this interest period. The agent bank then divides that by the proportion of each lender, notifies the lender. The lender then at that stage, and only at that stage only, will it go into the bank and actually draw down those funds in the amount, in the currency, make them available to the agent bank, which will then be provided to the lender. This is how these markets work. We can change the currency with choice with regards to use of optional currencies. If one currency is unavailable, we'll find an alternative currency, failing which we'll go back to the base currency. We can also change currencies, so we have provisions on that with a specified procedure. And then there's just specific clauses about calculating amounts when you've got different types of currencies after for different interest periods, one moving after the other. All the agent's calculations. We'll see that the agent's allowed to rely on all sorts of information provisions. There's a lot of protections which the agent's going to have made available, in particular under section 26. So we'll see some of the technical clauses in terms of the payment provisions, as well as this 6.5 here and the other mechanical clauses which actually determine how all of this is administered in practice. We have provisions on repayment, on prepayment, and on cancellation. So there's a series of options. We will have mandatory prepayment and cancellation in the event of illegality or change of control. In particular, where the company is no longer controlled by an original party, this will have been taken into account as an important, significant element of the original credit assessment, credit determination that each of the bank is making before they make the facilities available. This will all be explained and set out in the information memorandum. One of the key clauses, the key background factors, is who is the company, who owns the company. If the ownership of the company changes, that's a significant element the banks will want to be advised of, will want to take into account. This may mean that they want to withdraw the funds or not provide funds available, so we have the change of control and the illegality. We need to watch those. You're advising your clients at all times on all of the rights and obligations involved. We can have voluntary payment, voluntary prepayment, and we can have cancellation, but in these cases, especially on voluntary prepayment, that's where the break clause will be triggered. So we need to make sure that banks don't lose out and that any difference is covered, although they are under an obligation to re-lend the funds back into the market for the residual period. And then there's just other standard clauses in there on right to repayment and cancellation in relation to single lender, and then restrictions on the exercise of these powers. Cost of utilisation. This is the key provision with regards to what the borrowers actually pay. They will pay the margin, they will pay the risk-free rate, which is the rate at which the banks will obtain the funds on the local interbank market, and they will pay the mandatory cost. And then we will see how all of the other additional costs and indemnities will also be added to this. So we'll get the payment of interest. Interest is paid in arrears at the end of each interest period, subject to maximum gap of 6 months. There's default interest if you don't make payment. There's a higher interest payment imposed, and then that will be compounded. We'll see that in 9.3c. Compounding is where you pay, whereby you pay interest on top of interest effectively. So if you default in a payment, you pay a higher rate of interest, and you default on that, you pay higher again. Notification of rates, selection of interest periods, and you'll see there's the standard default 10.1c. If there's no selection, it's 1 month. We can change interest periods for the facility A's and for the facility B's in 10.2. Then we have non-business day provisions. And then this is the other clause, consolidation and division. I explained that we have to refer back to the limitation clause that we saw on the loans before. What will happen is this. If payments are to be made by the same borrower, on the same currency, on the same date, we will automatically consolidate those. So there might be 10 payments to the same borrower, same currency, same date. We consolidate those so there's only one. That's useful if we have a limit on the total number. But we can also, we can divide. The borrowers themselves can ask for loans to be divided. I'm not quite sure why they would want to do that. It might be for interest payments, it might be for tax reasons, it might be for accountancy reasons, or it might be just to allocate the payments between themselves. If there's changes, we have a market disruption event, there's no screen rate, we need to have alternative provisions so that we can get a relevant rate, which is acceptable. If that doesn't operate, then we'll have a negotiation, and I think it's 30 days from memory. That will be an 11.3, so that the agent and the company enter into negotiations to calculate an alternative system for calculating the interest, which will be due for the relevant PD, essentially tied to whatever the bank's costs of funding are. That's what it will always apply. There's the break costs we've mentioned already. Then there's the fees, the commitment fee, the arrangement fee, and the agency fee. The commitment fee is for the banks making the facility available, standing as a party. Once they've drawn that, once amounts have been drawn down, you pay the commitment fee in relation to the amount that's not drawn down. Once it's drawn down, you pay, the borrowers will pay the interest on the amount that's been acquired. Arrangement fee is paid to the arranging bank. Agency fee is paid to the agent bank. That's generally on an hourly basis. And you'll actually see that's referred to subsequently in the paper. I think it's clause, it's an hourly rate. I think it's clause 2615, so we'll see that subsequently. The agent bank normally charges on a simple hourly rate, so that would be very small in comparison to the 0.5 even more percentage fee on the whole facility that the arranging bank is going to charge, and then slightly smaller amount that will be made in terms of the quite a larger amount. There will be a big difference that will be paid on the commitment fee. It will be a lot smaller as well. Additional payment obligations, these are the tax gross-up provisions. You just need to work through these, make sure you're familiar with them and that you understand them. A lot of them are in basically standard terms and conditions, what we'd expect in practice. The key tax gross-up is in 13.2. Each obligor shall make all payments to be made by it without any tax deduction, unless a tax deduction is required by law. And then if a tax deduction is required, you have to gross up. That's the key grossing up provision that we would expect in any of these clauses. And we'll see that in C. The obligor shall be obliged to increase the amount, which leaves an amount equal to the payment which would have been due if no tax deduction had been required. So if it's, the payment is 100, for example, $100,000, if it's a 10% withholding, you don't gross up to 110, you gross up to 111, so that when you take 10% of 111 off 111, you get 100. Because otherwise it would be 10% of 110 is 11, 110 from less 11 is 99. So the banks wouldn't receive everything they expected, so you would breach the tax gross-up provision in 13.2.C. You've also got a separate tax indemnity clause in 13.3, and then you've got an obligation to pay any stamp taxes. Any tax credit will be deducted. You also have, the borrowers also have to pay any stamp duty that's imposed. There might be stamp duty because this is a service, but because it's of a wholesale nature, that may not be relevant depending upon the particular country, particular transaction we're looking at. PTR generally refers to a provisional treaty relief arrangement. Most of the main, all the main financial centres will have double tax treaties with each other. You just need to watch the provisions. The objective is that you don't have charges inside transactions so that the borrowers pay the full amounts to the lenders and the lenders only pay tax on their total net profit at the end of each year, What you don't want are all sorts of ancillary charges in between. So we just have to look at the various provisions within double taxation treaties. This is just a specific type of element of that with regards to these PTR schemes. You've also then got other increased costs, so the borrowers have to pay any other increased costs, and then you can just look at the specific drafting of that to see what these may include. 14.1, 14.2. Reduction in the rate of return, any additional or increased cost of any form, any reduction of any other amount due. Similar to a tax gross up, but any type of increased cost has to be covered. There's notification provisions with the increased cost claims, and then there's certain exceptions which do not have to be covered. There's also a separate currency indemnity. Any other indemnities, which include, for example, in the event of an event of default, failure to pay other funding or making arrangements, or a loan is not prepaid in accordance with the notice given. So any other indemnities, and then a separate indemnity to the agent bank. So again, if you multiply all these through, we're going to find out that in addition to the three basic payments in clause 9.1, you've got something like 12, 14, 16 additional payments which the obligors are required to make. The lenders are subject to a mitigation provision in 16.1, although the terms are generously drafted in favour of the lending bank. So a finance party is not obliged to take any steps in relation to mitigation if, in its opinion, acting reasonably to do so might be prejudicial to it. So, I mean, a very powerful safeguard clause. If the banks don't want to do it, very often they won't want to do it. But we have appropriate drafting so that all this is as professional and as fair and reasonable as we can get. Although that clause generally clearly favours the banks, and it's something you may want to discuss if you're acting for the borrowers. And then again, additional provisions that the borrowers have to pay. So we've got transaction expenses, amendment costs, and any other enforcement costs. And you just check the drafting of each of these. We'll then get guarantees and indemnities. These are very well drafted provisions, standard clauses, but they reflect a lot of complex, difficult laws on guarantees and indemnities, which you will become increasingly aware of over time. These are very well drafted. The key point is this: the difference between a guarantee and an indemnity. So it's guaranteeing and indemnity. A guarantee is basically an undertaking to make payment in the event that another payment has not been made. So a guarantee is conditional on non-payment and on the liability still arising under the original obligation to make payment. So it's conditional on an underlying obligation still being due. An indemnity is an independent, separate, open obligation to cover any losses which may be incurred. So an indemnity is much wider than a guarantee. And what we'll see is this: these provisions provide for guarantees and indemnities. And in practice, the courts, there's a lot of case law in this area which draw very fine distinctions between whether it's a guarantee or whether it's an indemnity. And if it's a guarantee, if the principal obligation has been discharged, relieved, or is not otherwise due, then the guarantor isn't under any obligation to make payment. There's all sorts of quite complex issues which arise here. These clauses reflect standard practice, but they're very well drafted because they build and incorporate all the key sets of provisions that we have to expect in practice. So you'll see guarantees punctual performance, undertakes whenever a borrower does not pay, the guarantor shall immediately on demand make that payment, but then separately indemnifies. So guarantee and then indemnity, so two different obligations because one's independent and separate and the other's conditional on the other previous non-payment, any other cost, loss or liability. The guarantees are continuing. We will restate them. There's no waiver of defence. The borrower, any obligor, waives all their defences so that they still have to make full payment under the guarantees and indemnities. There is immediate recourse, 18.5. We protect any appropriations. We defer the guarantor's rights. If they have any rights, they're deferred until the lenders have received all payments that they are due. We can release, and we may take additional security. So you just need to check these provisions and make sure you're clear and that your clients are clear. We then have the standard representations and warranties that we'd expect. So representations, status, binding obligations, non-conflict, power and authority, validity and admissibility, governing law and enforcement. And all I've done in my own copy is I simply work through these and I just mark them all up. I mark everything up in black, blue and red so that I'm clear on the nature of each of these provisions. You need to read them because you will not understand them unless you actually go over them and then become familiar with them so you know what's expected in practice in terms of basic normal drafting. If you know what's expected, then you know when something's missing or when something goes too far, you'll be able to identify negotiation points. So, status, binding obligations, non-conflict, power and authority, validity and admissibility, governing law and enforcement, and again, you can cross-refer those to the later clauses in the provision. Deduction of tax, no filing of stamp duties, no default. So remember, no default is in the utilisation request provisions, and then again, it'll be repeated in the default clauses. So as you're marking this up, you're incorporating all these cross-reference to all these other different clauses in the document. No misleading statements. We'll come back to that. Misrepresentations. We'll see that again in the representations, the other provisions, the default clauses later. Financial statements have been prepared in accordance with the relevant GAAP, which might be US GAAP, or in this case it'll be UK GAAP. We're trying to move towards international financial standard reporting, but we haven't quite done that in America, but the American authorities no longer require all of these documents to be separately reconciled with US GAAP, which before was a substantial obligation. Pari passu ranking, all of the obligations rank pari passu with any other unsecured and unsubordinated creditors. It doesn't say this has to be equal with everything, it's unsecured and unsubordinated, because clearly the borrowers may have entered into separate security arrangements with separate secured facilities with other creditors at different times. No proceedings pending or threatened, and again we'll see that repeated later. Repetition, we can have repeating representations. These are repeated on each utilisation, that's each drawdown, and then with regards to each additional, that's new obligors, guarantors or borrowers, when they come in, they're effectively repeating all of these again. The information undertakings, so we have financial statements, compliance certificates, that's provided for in the schedule or standard clause, and then requirements as to financial statements more generally. Information miscellaneous, we just simply need to work through these provisions. The banks need and will collect a large amount of financial documentation, a large amount of financial compliance certification, so that they can satisfy themselves as to the condition of the borrower and the borrower's group, so that they are confirmed and of the opinion the borrower will be able to make all of the payments due under this facility. That's the original credit assessment. What banks do is they gather information, they decide, will I lend, how much will I lend, how long for, and at what cost. And if it's high risk, the cost goes up. It's as simple as that. That's the original credit assessments that banks make in all lending arrangements. What we will see later, in particular in Clause 26 and certain other provisions, the banks have to make their own original credit assessment. They cannot rely on the arranging bank or the Asian bank or any other party. All of this they do themselves because they're acting as independent parties in this documentation. So again, we will see that reflected in all of the key financial provisions provided for. If there's any default, this must be immediately notified by the obligors to the agent bank. The agent bank will then notify the lenders and appropriate action will be taken. In the event that there is default, the LMA will have a clause on this, and we'll see this in 2313, essentially provides for acceleration. In my opinion, there's five core remedies we need to consider generally. If default is triggered, we have suspension of further advances, we have cancellation of further advances. We have acceleration of repayments. We have rescission of the documentation. And then we can separately sue for damages in court. The use of websites, a lot of the information provided can be made available simply through website filing. This will be managed through the agent bank. All of the parties just agree to this, confirm, provide the relevant addresses with passcodes and access numbers. Very often in practice, the borrowers will want to do it this way. They don't want to submit large amounts of continuing ongoing financial documentation for up to 20 years. If it can all be done electronically, that's even better. Now there's very often even computer programs that will do all this for them. Know your customer checks are for money laundering purposes. If the any in each of the lenders have to conduct know your customer requirements under their own relevant laws and jurisdictions, the borrower has to provide all of the relevant information on request so that the banks can be satisfied that this is not for criminal purposes, this is not involved with money laundering or separately anti-terrorist financing. Then we have the financial covenants. This will be one of the most important clauses in the document and it's blank. Because the LMA does not draft these specifically, these will be prepared by the accountants and auditors acting for the borrowers, or acting for the lenders, and very often they'll just use standard documentation which is provided in the market, although depending upon the risk involved, you'll just adjust the figures. That's not your responsibility, but as a lawyer, you need to be aware of this as well. I'll provide sample documentation for typical financial covenants, and then I deal with all of this in further detail in my separate chapter on project finance. So then we have the general undertaking. So the CoVs, the ongoing covenants, include the financials and then the corporate CoVs. So financials and corporates. The key corporates are authorizations. So already we're beginning to see how this repeats. So in the CPs and in the representations and in the CoVs, a lot of the key things will be repeated that will come up again. So those are the provisions you're looking for to try and see how all of this links together. We have authorizations, compliance, and then we have the negative pledge clause. The negative pledge is very important because we want to restrict the ability of the borrowers to grant preferential security, which may undermine the ability of the banks to recover their funds due. But we have to be careful how we draft this. We need it to be as wide as possible to include all forms of security in relation to all forms of indebtedness. So you'll check all of these key terms, but also we need to have exclusions because very often this can include all sorts of things which we may not typically expect. For example, photocopy machines will be subject to like liens or retention of title clauses. There's all sorts of daily provisions. We do not want that to trigger a retention of title clause in a coffee machine or a photocopy machine. We don't want that to trigger default. And then to trigger default and of course default on $1 billion or $1 trillion worth of other facility available because the kettle was more expensive than expected or the photocopy machine didn't comply with something. So we need to be careful about this. What we'll also specifically include, there'll be a de minimis provision. So below a certain value, and you'll see that there, that's the blank amount. So we need this to be as wide as possible to cover any indebtedness, to cover any security, but then again, we need a reasonable set of exemptions and exclusions because we don't want to trigger default unnecessarily. What the banks want to happen is this: when something goes wrong, they want to be notified because then they can be consulted and then they can agree what's going to happen. But they want to be in the stronger position so they can protect their interests because they're making the 100 million funds available, which they're legally obliged to repay to their own lenders. So they need to be able to protect their interests. So that's what we're doing with all of these relevant provisions, all of these different clauses. Disposals, we need to ensure that there's no material assets being disposed of, which again could prejudice the interests of the banks without consent or notification. Merger, again, if there's any merger without assumption of responsibilities and liabilities, we need to watch that. It's a standard clause. We'll see the equivalent provision in the International Swaps and Derivatives Association documentation for derivatives. But again, we can see how these clauses overlap because we saw at the very beginning on the cancellations and the prepayments and the utilization, if the company is change of control, that would actually mean the lenders didn't have to make any funds available at all. So we need to watch that. And again, change of business. If there's any material change of business detrimental to the lenders, we need to watch that. And then, if anything goes wrong, we now have the events of default. So we're going to have a standard list of key default provisions, and we need to ensure that all of these cover all of the relevant protections and rights and entitlements that we would expect. Non-payment, so financial non-payment. Any other breach of any other covenants, any other breach of any other obligations. Misrepresentation, remember we already had these clauses before, so we can cross-refer back and forward to these relevant provisions. Cross-default, so we look at the cross-default clause. It will be defined in terms of financial indebtedness of any form of any member of the group. And that's even wider. It's not even any obligor, which is guarantor or borrower, it's any member of the group. So it's even wider than we might expect. You need to watch that. So again, you go back and check your financial indebtedness. That was defined in the key provisions at the beginning. Insolvency, other insolvency proceedings, or any other creditor process. All of these trigger default. Change of ownership, again, we've got the merger provision, we've got the change of ownership clause we saw before. Mark this all up for the cross-references. And then unlawfulness, repudiation, and then a standard MAC, material adverse change. And I'll give you drafting for different material adverse change clauses. The LME then specify that the defence, the events of default, have three consequences. Cancel total commitments, declare all loans to be immediately due and payable, and then declare all loans payable on demand. That simply reflects different case law under English law. And if someone wished to spend some time on this, you could actually work out exactly what case those refer to. In my opinion, there's five consequences, as I've said already. It's suspension, cancellation, acceleration, rescission, and damages. We then have standard clauses with regards to change of party. So we can change the lenders, and you'll see there, the company has to consent, but consent is not to be unreasonably withheld. That's in 24.2b. The same courtesy is not actually extended when we're changing the obligors and the guarantors. We'll see that later. Assignment on transfer. So again, we can have transfer using the transfer form provided in the schedule. It could either be a novation, which will be Schedule 5, or I think the new clauses, the new versions, have Schedule 6 as an assignment. Limitation and responsibility of existing lenders and then new lenders coming in. Transfer procedures, notification, documents. Changes to obligors, additional borrowers, additional guarantors. You repeat the representations, resignation of the guarantor. All the lenders have to consent. That's in 25.6b2, with no obligation for this not to be unreasonably withheld. If any of the lenders think that they'll be prejudiced if one of the guarantors is released, they will just say no, and there's nothing that can be done. And then we've got important clauses with regards to the rights and obligations of the arranger and of the agent bank. So each finance party appoints the agent to act as the agent on their behalf in connection with the finance document. So it doesn't say that finance party, it says each finance party will appoint the agent bank. So each of them has a direct relationship with the agent bank. Each authorises the agent bank to exercise all of its rights, powers and authorities, and then we'll see there's a lot of protections in favour of the agent bank made available. The duties of the agent bank are defined narrowly, and I have a separate chapter on agent and arranging bank liability. One of the easiest ways to limit liability is to limit duty, because if you're not liable to do something, you cannot be liable for not doing it. So the easiest, most simple way to limit liability is to limit the original duty. So that's why we specify the duties of the agent in narrow administrative terms, so that it cannot be held liable for all sorts of things which it didn't intend, or it didn't expect, or it didn't know about. So the duties of the agent bank, it's forwarding information, it's review, notifying of defaults, very, very narrow. the role of the arranger, this is important, except as otherwise specifically provided, the arranger has no obligations, no legal duties of any form under this agreement to any party in connection with this documentation. The arranger is the key bank which will have set up the facility. It brings all the other members into the syndicate. It helps prepare the information memorandum. It will have taken the initial mandate letter, drafted the term sheet. It basically runs everything. But what's its legal responsibilities? None. And we specify that. Why? No duty, no liability. No fiduciary duties. Neither the agent bank nor the arranging bank have any fiduciary duties of any form whatsoever. However, they are allowed to conduct any other business. So some of the provisions are negative, some of them are positive. The agent bank has a number of other protections. So it can rely, so this is reliance. 26.6 is reliance. 26, that's A. B is assumption. It can assume all these things. It can engage, that's engagement in C. It can act, that's D in subsection D. Disclosure in E. And notwithstanding any other provision to the contrary, it's not obliged to do. Neither the agent nor the arranger can be required to do anything which would otherwise breach law or fiduciary or other duty of confidentiality. So an extended range of protections, an extended range of powers and protections, as well as exclusions and controls. The agent bank can also act on majority lender's instructions. So this is an important provision because this specifies to what extent we can rely on majority lenders, although we'll see later this is actually defined in further detail. Responsibility for documentation. Neither the agent nor the arranger is responsible for the accuracy, adequacy, completeness of any information, or for the legality, validity, or effectiveness. We'll then get the general exclusion clause. We always look at this. And what we'll see is this is in very wide terms. So only if there is gross negligence or willful misconduct, that's 26.9a, can there be any liability on the part of the agent bank. So it's not even the arranging bank, because we saw from the previous provision, the arranging bank got no duty under 26.3. So the exclusion clause, in very general terms, only applies to the agent bank, and even then, only if it's grossly negligent or there's willful misconduct can they be held liable in any way. The lender's liability, they have to pay the agent bank, and we saw there was a liability indemnity provision before in favour of the agent bank on behalf of the borrower. Resignation, there's a quite complex set of procedures in terms of resignation. What we're trying to do is always appoint a new agent bank before the first one resigns. You can work through that. Then there's confidentiality. We have to protect confidentiality. The agent may treat each lender as a lender entitled to payments. So again, there's a lot of series of provisions which allow the parties to engage with each other and engage with the borrower on an open way. Credit appraisal by the lenders. This is what I said before. All of the lenders are undertaking their own original separate credit assessment. They're not relying on the arranging bank or any other party, each other. They're taking it by themselves. So this confirms the independence and the separate and several nature of all of the duties involved. Additional provisions, agents' management time. That's how we bill on an hourly basis. Any deductions. Conduct of business, parties can engage with each other in general other ways. And then the sharing clauses. This is where we have to share so that all payments are made equal, unless, as I said before, this is in 26.5b2, if a finance party invited other parties to engage and to participate in the proceedings, but they chose not to, if there is a recovery, they can keep that without making payment. We'll then get the basic administration provisions, payment mechanics, clawback if a payment was made which shouldn't have been made, no set-off by the obligors, but we're going to see full set-off retained in favour of the lenders, change of currency clause, disruption clauses, there's the set-off provision 30. Notices, how do we make notices? Delivering documents, again it might seem detailed, but you need to read these, you should be familiar with this. What are the key provisions with regards to when does something have legal effect? when you're delivering notices, either in paper, by post, or by email, or by fax. When is delivery effective? You need to watch these. You need to be familiar with these clauses. You will be asked this at some point in your professional life. Notifications, electronic communications, that's on emails, English language clause, cancellation of certificates, partial invalidity, no partial ineffectiveness undermines the legal enforceability of any other provision, no remedies and waivers. Then we have the standard multi-counterparty clause, and then we have the core provisions on governing law and enforcement. Each of these provisions and sub-provisions will reflect a case law in this case, so you cannot have exclusive jurisdiction provisions, for example. So this is carefully drafted to make sure this is fully enforceable. In practice, generally, it will be English law and New York law and London and New York for the enforcement. It may be other laws, increasingly, but we will look at that. It depends upon the power and the nature and the source, the origins of the lending bank's concern. If they all come from the Middle East, very often they might use Dubai law, for example. And Dubai is becoming a very important, well-respected commercial centre. Shanghai, maybe less so. Hong Kong, perfectly legitimate, because it basically applies English law, English legal procedure. A lot of other jurisdictions, not that common. You could still use Japanese law, for example, and have the jurisdiction in Hong Kong, or even still London. That's very common. And then the schedules. So, there's the parties, there's the conditions precedent, additional conditions precedent, there's the drawdown, the utilisation, selection notices, mandatory cost, transfer certificate, and you'll see there in 2A, by novation. So this is a novation. There's now a standard assignment provided as well. Form of accession, form of resignation, compliance certificate, existing security, if it has to be disclosed, confidentiality, LME has that separately available on the website, and timetables. And with all of that, you can understand one of the most important core legal documents in the financial world. You have the key set of provisions, the master document. You also have an outline, and you have various other support documents so you can understand the other key gap clauses. This is absolutely core in terms of key financial market practice, financial preparation. I strongly encourage you to spend some time working through this and becoming familiar with this.